From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Special welcome to all of our listeners around the country on
150 affiliates.
Summer is a great time for kids and adults to enjoy the warmer weather and get outdoors.
Activities like biking and rollerblading, swimming and boating can be a great way to fill your summer days. But with increased activity comes increased risk of injury and visits to the emergency department.
On today's program, we'll get some summertime safety tips from a Mayo Clinic expert.
Also on the program, we'll learn about the importance of play, how even adults can reap the benefits of time on the playground or a game of tag.
And we'll hear from an expert on how to avoid salmonella and keep foods safe in the summertime heat.
All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Summertime is here, finally. And the 4th of July holiday, it's not too far away either. And summer means that kids are out of school and it's time for fun in the sun and family vacations. Summer activities like biking, swimming, boating, or even riding a four-wheeler. You got one of those?
No.
One for your kids,
no.
I bet. Riding a four-wheeler can be a lot of fun, but they also require some common sense and a little caution to stay safe and healthy.
Emergency departments are busy during summer months as kids and adults are more active, which means more injuries. Here to discuss summertime safety is Mayo Clinic emergency medicine physician, Dr. Luke Wood. Welcome to the program, Dr. Wood. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Luke Wood, so great to have you on the program. Your father and I worked together for so many years, and your mom and dad have been friends of mine for so long, and you worked in the operating room.
Yeah, that was 1999 and 2000, I think.
Yeah, amazing. Then you went to medical school after that.
I did, yeah.
And where'd you go?
I went to University of New England.
And good?
Yeah.
And then you stayed out there and were practicing in the emergency room out there for a while?
Yeah, I did my emergency medicine residency out in Portland, Maine, and then I was out in practice out there for about 4 years.
How did you choose emergency medicine?
I liked the variety of kind of the different things that you saw. You kind of took care of the whole person and everything from, you know, injured toes to psychiatric emergencies and everything in between.
And the other good thing about it, too, isn't it, is the regular hours. I mean, you work
sure.
at 8 or 10 or 12 hour shift and you're done. You don't have to worry about them when you go home because somebody else is taking them over.
Well, you know, the shift work is a part of it. It doesn't always really jive with your circadian rhythm necessarily, but...
You worked different shifts.
Correct.
So you might work overnight and then you might work during the day and 12-hour shifts usually, 10 or 12?
Tim, you know, I work both here in Rochester and over in Red Wing. And so in the community sites, oftentimes you do a little bit longer shifts, like 12 hours. Here in Rochester, where it's kind of busy around the clock, we typically do 8 and 9 hour shifts.
Okay, I have one really important question before we get started with the meat of this program and safety in the summer. And that is, how come you have to wait so long in the emergency room?
Right off the bat, welcome to the program.
We want to hear it right from the horse's mouth. What are you doing back there?
It's a popular place to be, especially during the summertime. Unfortunately, you know, in the summer months, we always see a surge in patient volume, so that typically correlates with a little bit longer waiting times. But we try to do our best to kind of move people through and kind of sort out the really sick people from people who might just need a quick evaluation.
And that's a big part of the problem, isn't it? There are a lot of people who are there who don't have a true emergency.
True, yeah. And the causes for that are pretty complex.
Sure.
Probably a little bit beyond our time here, but that's true. We see kind of a lot of primary care issues in the emergency department as well as true emergencies.
All right, so let's talk about summertime. I would imagine that no matter what the season is, in the wintertime, you've probably got other issues that people come to the emergency department for, but is summertime the most active at the ER?
Typically speaking, I mean, if you look at emergency department volumes across the country, I would say that most emergency departments are going to see a surge in summer volume. It's probably a little bit different when you're kind of in the mountains of Colorado and that type of thing, where they get more of kind of a winter tourism. But here in the upper Midwest, summers are definitely the busiest time of year for us in the emergency department.
And what are you seeing? What's a typical day for you? the most common things that you see?
Well, I mean, typically in the emergency department, just regardless of the season, you see your fair amount of, you know, shortness of breath, abdominal pain, chest pain, that type of thing. Kind of in the summertime in particular, you're seeing a bit more of people kind of getting injured or becoming sick because of exposure to some outdoor elements that they're maybe not totally prepared for. Everything from sunburn to dehydration. We see kind of an increase in traumatic-related injuries during the summer because people are out just on the roads more often. Oftentimes people are imbibing to different degrees as well, which can certainly affect rates of traumatic injuries. And so in the, during the summer, we always see kind of an increase in both kind of more mild injuries related to summertime activities, tick bites, running into poison ivy, contact dermatitis, that type of thing, and then more serious thing like car accidents and ATV accidents.
Motorcycles?
Motorcycles, too.
You don't have a motorcycle, do you?
I do not own a motorcycle, no.
Do you know any emergency room physician who does?
Maybe.
Yeah, but you don't have to work there very long to know you don't want a motorcycle, and you want your kids to have a motorcycle.
Got it. think that
that'd bring back some bad memory.
That's good advice right there. Yeah. I would think that because it is summertime, that heat-related issues are some of the things that you see people about the most, or not.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's a very common complaint that we see in the emergency department. And oftentimes it's kind of a double-headed monster where there's kind of the exposure to heat and then some degree of dehydration. And that can affect different people to kind of varying degrees. You know, especially in kind of the elderly population, we'll see kind of an increase in heat-related complaints like dehydration or heat stroke itself.
Do I remember that if for children and the elderly, the problem is that their body isn't able to monitor the effect of heat like adults can.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably for a variety of reasons. I mean, one reason for that is that kind of the extremes of age just aren't able to communicate some of their symptoms. And so kind of some of the vague symptoms that go along with heat exhaustion or heat stroke, like dizziness or confusion, you might not really pick up on as much as somebody who's otherwise able to tell you kind of all the symptoms that they're feeling.
So what's the treatment? What do you do if somebody comes in with a heat stroke, heat exhaustion? Obviously, you try to cool them down, but and how do you do that? And what's the treatment?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you try to kind of bring their body temperature back down to a more normal range. And oftentimes, just getting somebody into air conditioning, which I think I can say with a reasonable degree of confidence that all of the emergency departments in the Mayo Clinic health system are air conditioned. You know, just getting them into some air conditioning, with no humidity, will oftentimes kind of abate some of those symptoms. But oftentimes, like I was saying, you know, there's a concurrent issue going on with some dehydration, and so oftentimes these folks need IV fluids, and they need to be monitored. Typically, these people will get some blood work and be monitored closely for a period of time.
What about so that people don't have to come to the emergency room to see you? If, you know, you're out at a kid's ball game or you're running at a 5K or whatever, how can you recognize that you're starting to have some heat-related issues?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, oftentimes for kind of early heat exhaustion, some of the symptoms are fairly vague, but some dizziness, some nausea are kind of oftentimes the first symptoms, oftentimes a headache. And so really good hydration and then staying out of the heat as much as possible. So finding some shade, finding some air conditioning if you're starting to feel those symptoms, and then really starting to drink lots of fluids. And I'm not, you know, talking about Pepsi or anything like that. I think, you know, clear fluids is kind of ideally what people ought to consume in those situations. Oftentimes when people run into dehydration in the emergency department and I'm sending them home, one hydration strategy that I'll kind of suggest to them is if they buy a bottle of the powdered Gatorade and then make that kind of at half strength, gives them some electrolytes, gives them a little bit of flavor, and I find people kind of will be a little bit more mindful of how many fluids they're taking.
All right, emergency room physician Dr. Luke Wood, time for a short break.
When we come back, myth or matter of fact, kids need to wait 30 minutes after eating before they swim.
It was an hour when I grew up.
Yeah, we'll find out. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
We are with ER Doc, Dr. Luke Wood. Dr. Wood, great to have you with us. We're going to start off with a myth or matter of fact.
Kids need to wait 30 minutes after eating before they swim. Dr. Wood, is that a myth or is that a fact?
Ooh.
Ooh.
I'll go with fact.
Okay.
Really?
Well, you know, the theory is that, at least my understanding is that kids can kind of develop a side stitch or kind of a cramp, which can impair their ability to swim. I don't think it's a, I think 30 minutes is probably a little bit on the generous side. I'd say I'm guessing more so kind of 10 or 15 minutes would be a little bit more, more along the lines of reason.
Yeah, well, you know what? I thought you were going to say, no, you can go right in the water after you eat. I mean, it, theoretically, is it that all the blood flow of your body is going to your stomach to help digest your hot dog, and that's why your muscles aren't working so well? Or what's the reason behind it? I mean, when I grew up, it was 60 minutes. My mom wouldn't let me close to the water for 60 minutes.
She loved you very much.
I know, I did know that. She's the reason I survived.
Like I said, I thought that the kind of issue was that kids can develop kind of abdominal cramps or kind of side stitches when if they go in the water right after they eat. I don't know. I guess I've never taken care of a patient in the emergency setting who's run into this particular issue.
All right. Well, let's talk about helmets. I bet you have had that issue come up for kids and adults. Helmets are mandatory.
They're mandatory in my book. You know, I'm an avid bike rider, and I think the importance of helmet use can't be really emphasized enough. You know, specifically for bike riding, oftentimes what happens, especially with little kids, is you've got kind of a collection of helmets in your garage, and in the springtime you go out and you start trying out which one seems to work this year, and it's really
which one looks the best.
Sure, that's the more important thing.
It used to be which one felt the best, but now it's which one looks the best.
But a proper fit certainly is necessary. You don't want that helmet kind of jostling around on top of the kid's head. It's always a good idea to kind of go in at least maybe one time during the season, especially kids who are growing like weeds, to make sure that their helmet's fitting properly. Really any of the local bike stores can help you out with that. I do think that a good helmet is a very worthwhile investment. If you actually make an in-store purchase instead of purchasing it online, you can make sure that it's fitting your kid properly, and you know, then the sales agent can make sure that it's appropriately sized.
You better stick with the Exercycle.
Oh, very good.
I think so. Let's talk a little bit about drowning. Especially in the summertime with a little bit of alcohol on board, it's a not too uncommon problem. And then there's this issue of dry drowning, which I actually hadn't heard the term used before. What's dry drowning?
Sure. Well, this particular issue has kind of received some attention lately because of some unfortunate events that have occurred around the country recently. But dry drowning is this idea where, you know, typically a child will survive a near-drowning incident, and then they'll develop some respiratory failure either hours or days on down the road. And there's really kind of two different processes that are ongoing, both of which are extremely rare. And I think it's important that listeners understand that these events truly are rare. But with a dry drowning, essentially what oftentimes happens is a little bit of fluid hits the vocal cords, and then those vocal cords go into spasm. Several hours to days later, there can be kind of an inflammatory reaction that exists down in the lungs that causes some respiratory failure, again, typically occurring you know, around the time where the initial near-drowning incident happens, but, you know, kids or adults can become sick in the hours or days leading up to the event or following the event.
So if there is a near-drowning, that is something that you want to watch out for in the coming days that follow.
Sure. I mean, you know, anytime there's a near drowning incident, I don't think it's a bad idea to come into an emergency department to be evaluated. Generally speaking, when people feel normal after a near drowning incident, they regain consciousness, they're acting like themselves, and they're not having any respiratory symptoms. Almost all the time, those folks are generally out of the woods. There are these rare cases where people will go on to develop some respiratory issues later on, but that's either because of that dry and drowning incident, or sometimes if people aspirate some fluid at the time of their near-drowning incident, that can cause an inflammatory reaction in the lungs that, again, can develop some issues in the days following a near-drowning event.
So you get the water, contaminated water, swimming pool water with chlorine in it, down into your lungs. So you basically aspirate.
Correct, yeah.
And then what was the other cause of dry drowning that you mentioned?
So there's
two different things.
Yeah, there's kind of two different things. There's the whole idea of dry drowning, which is where the people have spasm of the vocal cords.
Oh, so you can't breathe.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
The vocal cords come together and block off your airway.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
And then there's this whole idea of secondary drowning, and a lot of medical sources have been kind of getting away from the terminology secondary drowning or dry drowning. But in this kind of secondary drowning, that's when there's a generalized inflammatory reaction in the lungs, usually due to some aspirated water of some sort.
Dr. Shives also mentioned alcohol, and you could say the effect of alcohol with swimming or boating or fill in the blank. I mean, how does alcohol have a special danger element to swimming? Is there anything?
Good question. I mean, it's certainly one of the most closely associated risk factors with drowning incidents. And oftentimes we see kind of two age groups that are particularly affected by drowning. Kids less than 5 years of age, and that's often because of lack of parental supervision and a variety of other reasons. And then also kind of in the 15 to 25 age range for males, and that's oftentimes when alcohol is involved.
All right, we're coming up on July 4th. Are we going to air this program before July 4th? All right, so we got to ask you about fireworks. Tell us about, we all know that where alcohol is sometimes involved, again, or not infrequently involved. Tell us about one of the more interesting fireworks injuries you've seen.
Well, that's a good way to put it. I'd say, well, or 12-year-olds are involved. There's fireworks injuries all over the place.
Well, let's see here. Before moving back to Minnesota a few years ago, I was practicing emergency medicine out in Maine, and I was practicing kind of in the rural part of Maine. And we had a really wet and rainy 4th of July one year, and one individual had decided to take a whole bunch of fireworks and duct tape them together and then twist the fuse together and then cut the fuse short. It didn't go well for him. Common sense is really kind of important with fireworks. You kind of hit the nail on the head that alcohol is oftentimes involved, but oftentimes it's from either misuse of the fireworks or from like a faulty igniting system with the firework.
So the thing blew up quite close to him.
In his hand.
That's a five-finger problem.
A few moments left. What would be the last piece of emergency room expert advice you want to share with our listeners?
Common sense. We see kind of two varieties of summer-related issues in the emergency department. Mild ones, which, sunburn, heat exhaustion, poison ivy, that type of thing, and then more major ones. And so if there's anything I can emphasize to the listeners to try to minimize your risk to those kind of more major events, and so helmet use, avoiding alcohol when you're operating motor vehicles or when you're in the water, especially with little ones. We touched a little bit on ATV use. We always see every summer a handful of patients who end up getting really injured using ATVs when they don't really know how to, or if they're using them after night and they're not really a proficient rider. And so whatever you're doing, certainly use your brain and then protect your brain with the helmet.
All right, we've been talking about summertime safety. And yeah, just because it looks pretty doesn't mean it fits right.
I like that. Protect your brain with a helmet.
We've been talking about summertime safety and drowning with ER physician Dr. Luke Wood. Thanks so much for being with us. And safe summer, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Sanj Kakkar joins me as co-host. We'll learn about the importance of play, even for adults.
And later on in the program, Dr. Jake Strand takes a turn co-hosting. We'll get tips on keeping your picnic food safe in the summertime heat.
It's his first venture as a co-host, Dr. Shives.
Yeah, good for him.
Have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send an email to mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. changes in your skin can be clues that there's an internal issue with your health.
When a patient is concerned about that, their doctors will send them to see me, and I'll sort of canvas their skin to see if I can see any of the typical findings that could help with the diagnosis. And so it's sort of a detective work.
Dermatologist Dr. Lisa Draghi says certain conditions can cause specific skin changes. Lupus can carry many skin issues, the most typical of which is a butterfly-shaped rash on the face. Thyroid disease can cause dry skin. Gluten sensitivity or celiac disease can trigger a super itchy rash called dermatitis herpetiformis.
Itchy bubbles or blisters on usually the elbows, the knees, the back of the scalp.
And stress can make you itch all over and prompt flare-ups of acne. Dr. Draghi says many people worry that a skin issue may be a sign of an internal problem.
Sometimes there is. Many times I can just reassure them that they're okay.
For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Jake Strand.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Do you remember your school days? Many of us couldn't wait to take a break and head out to the playground. Recess was a daily part of life growing up, and childhood play is still recognized as an important part of brain development.
But as we grow up, does our need for play change? Mm-hmm. Maybe not. The National Institute for Play is researching the importance of play at every stage of life, including adulthood. Here to discuss why adults need play is Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program physical therapist Danny Johnson. Welcome back to the program, Danny. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Tracy. It's a joy to be here. Thank you.
The concept play for adults when all three of us are sitting here at work, I really like it a lot. So tell me, what does that mean when you say play for adults? What are you talking about?
So Tracy, in our program at the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program, we work with adults to try to really build their physical activity. In a lot of cases, they come to us and they're very interested in ways to be physically active, but the gym setting hasn't worked for them real well. They have a lot of responsibilities, a lot of kids at home, and they're looking for ways to integrate their world into their physical activity. So we use play in our program a lot of times to help build their physical activity into their life.
Danny, what sort of activities do you start to do to integrate that into their lives?
Sure. So it's highly individual. Mm-hmm. At the Healthy Living Program, we really want to take a look at each individual and see what works in their life. So a lot of times, for example, if they have a few kids, they don't have a gym membership, one of the biggest things we'll say is go out to the playground with your kids. Take them to the park. When they play on the jungle gym, you play on the jungle gym. So, you know, enjoy your children. You're getting that time with your children that we all crave, but you're also helping your physical fitness.
You mentioned the phrase gym setting, that in the gym setting. And for me, I don't really like gyms so much because I'm more of a social exerciser.
Right.
And unless I have somebody to go to the gym with me,
right,
I don't go to the gym.
Absolutely. And, you know, Tracy, I think that's really a key thing right now. We're seeing this, you know, upswing of things like CrossFit. We're seeing a lot of the mud runs or the fun runs. We're seeing people really resonate with those outlets and those ways of being physically active. And I do believe that socialization for a lot of people is a huge key. You know, if we go back to the fundamentals of play, socialization is really at the heart of that. And so a lot of these different settings or fun runs, or, you know, playing tennis, those social ways of being active, I think that's why we're seeing a lot more of that. We need to integrate a lot more fun into our physical activity and not think of it as another thing to do, another piece of work.
Well, that was the piece that I was curious about, the social concept, because I wonder,
right,
you know, for those who the gym hasn't worked, how does that social component increase maybe adherence or willingness to get out and do something that's outside of their comfort zone?
Yeah, absolutely, Jake. You know, that there's a lot of studies that do indicate that when we work out with a buddy, when we have that social aspect to our activity world, we stick with it. There's somebody to report to. There's somebody to meet at the location you choose to go out and be physically active at. So, and again, going back to play, you know, socialization, having fun, you sort of forget about time a little bit, and that makes you know, physical activity so much more.
There's a reinforcement there.
Absolutely.
I would never forget about time when I'm doing burpees, no matter if I'm doing it with 100 people or just myself. But how you mentioned like CrossFit,
yes,
you know, they're a gym that is basically a fitness center that is basically just a social kind of club type thing. But how are regular gyms, traditional gyms and fitness centers responding to the social aspect?
Well, I think you're seeing a lot more again, like the boot camps, you know, seeing, you're seeing a lot more classes really coming to light. You know, that was always a popular form, but I think now a lot of gyms are really integrating a lot more of the social aspect. I know I have a sister-in-law who's a spin instructor up in the Twin Cities area, and they have all kinds of different events that they throw, and after hours, you know, it's not just spinning anymore. So I think we are looking towards making physical activity a little bit more than just, I got to get to the gym, I got to run a half hour, I got to, you know, do this. So, you know, there's so much more to it. You know, it's mind-body, and we teach that, you know, in our program, that wellness and health, it goes way beyond just the act of physical activity. So I think we're seeing a lot more of that now.
Yeah, and that's I'd be really curious to follow up a bit more about the concept of wellness, because wellness is, you know, you mentioned not just about physical wellness, but it's also the community aspect.
Absolutely.
And so I wonder, what kind of benefits does that give us as adults compared to kids when we think about play?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that, you know, play can be a little different in kids and adults, but it's not that different. You know, it's really not. When you're a kid and you meet your neighborhood friends and you're playing kick the can, or, you know, there's a lot of social interaction and a lot of wellness, a lot of learning how to be in a society, and be with your friends and have fun. And, you know, there's a lot of that in adulthood as well. So we cannot forget about the benefits of play as they were as a child, because they are the same for us as adults. You know, we need that in our lives.
So you mentioned when you go to the playground with your kids, Dr. Strand's kids are little, so he's always going to win at tag.
That's true.
I have got preteens and teenagers, and I'm like the wounded deer at the watering hole. I mean, it's like I'm the easy pickings. They always go after mom.
Yeah.
Let's say that you are at the playground with your, or the area park with your grandkids or your kids.
Yeah.
What are some different things that you can do?
Well, Tracy, you actually just hit on a great point, because it's not just parents, it's grandparents too. So we want to bring play to all ages, all walks of life. For an example, I was up at the lake this weekend, and my 74-year-old grandmother was down on the ground crawling. You know, I'm a huge advocate of crawling. That's a whole other topic.
Oh, but, that's right. That's the first time we met
you. That's exactly right. Yes, I'm a huge advocate of crawling, but crawling and some of those other fundamental movement patterns do go back to play. Mm. So, you know, you can get on the ground. You can just play silly games. You know, even hopscotch, to be honest with you. You're working on hand-eye coordination, you're throwing a stone, you're hopping, you're working all of the muscles of the lower body, you're working on balance. So really any of those games from our youth, if you don't feel comfortable running and playing tag and all those things, think about some of the things that we used to do. You know, everything is able to come forward into our adulthood.
In the summertime, we go to a local elementary school that's in our neighborhood, and we get our four square on.
Yes.
Four square is coming back.
It's a great game. And think about the smile. I mean, you're smiling just thinking about
it. Yeah. And see, that one, I can hang with them.
Yes.
You
gotta
do it together.
You know, you got to do what works, Tracy. You got to do what works. But I think just, you know, even thinking back on that episode, it's bringing joy to your life. And I think sometimes in our world, we get so serious and we forget about that mind-body connection, and we forget about wellness as a whole. And we you know, do things in our physical activity lives that we don't love. And so, you know, I would really encourage everyone to give themselves permission to play.
And forgetting about not feeling awkward about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's a great point too, Jake, because I think a lot of people don't want to look silly as they get to be an adult, you know. There was a post on Mayo Clinic, a little quote about play. And I read through the comments, and one of the comments was, I have a job. I grew up. And to me, yes, you did. But that doesn't mean you can't have fun and do things you enjoy, and give yourself permission to play.
Yeah.
We've been talking adults and play with physical therapist Danny Johnson of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program. Thank you so much for joining us today, Danny.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we discuss picnic food safety with a Mayo Clinic expert.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Sanj Kakkar.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
It's picnic season and the time of year when reports of foodborne illnesses spike. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, one in six Americans get sick by consuming contaminated foods or beverages each year.
Ugh. Salmonella infection, salmonellosis, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. It's a common bacterial disease that affects the intestinal tract, causing nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. Salmonella infection is usually caused by eating raw or undercooked meat, poultry, eggs, or egg products. Here to discuss food safety is Mayo Clinic infectious disease specialist, Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse. Welcome to the program, Dr. Rajapakse. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me today. I'm excited to be here.
How common is salmonella?
So salmonella, up until this past year, used to be one of the most common causes of foodborne illness in the United States. This past year, for bacterial causes of foodborne illness, it was overtaken by Campylobacter, another type of bacteria, for the first time. But we do know each year in the United States, over a million people get sick from salmonella infection, and somewhere between 300 and 400 people will actually end up dying from it. So it is a serious condition and something that is relatively common.
And are there particular people at risk of getting salmonellosis?
Sure. So most otherwise healthy people, if they get a salmonella infection from something they eat or drink, will have what we call a self-limited illness. So as you mentioned, they may have some abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, but usually this will go away on its own and doesn't usually need treatment in otherwise healthy people. However, there are certain people in the population who would be at higher risk of having a severe illness. We see this especially in young children or infants, in the elderly population, or people who have problems with their immune system. These can be people who are on medication that suppresses their immune system, people with cancer or organ transplants.
As a child growing up, we would go to India very often, and it would be called Delhi Belly there, Tracy.
Oh, my.
And so how would one know if this is due to salmonella or, for example, like Campylobacter that you mentioned?
Sure. So there's a lot of overlap in the symptoms that people experience with foodborne illness. So based on the symptoms alone, it's really difficult to say exactly what the person has been infected with. It's also important to know that there's other non-infectious causes of things like abdominal pain and diarrhea that you need to keep in mind as well. So just from hearing what someone's symptoms are, it's impossible to know exactly what's causing it, though there are some exposures that we can look at, things that people may have eaten or had to drink that can point us in certain directions as to what they may be sick with.
I'm just to clarify, a norovirus or something when it's people are not washing their hands, and then that is spread through a restaurant if one of the food, you know, one of the workers has not washed their hands. Is that also considered a foodborne illness, or is that just a different public health problem altogether?
Yeah, so there's, I think, over 250 different things that cause foodborne illnesses that we know about now.
Wow.
And so they can be caused by viruses, by bacteria, by parasites. So norovirus would be an example of a type of virus that can cause foodborne illness. There's also things in food that can also make people sick, things such as toxins or certain chemicals that are not infections, obviously, but can also make people sick from things they eat and drink.
So maybe, Dr. Rajapakse, you can set a score here with my wife. The other day, we went out and we had eggs, and they were soft-boiled, and I thought that was okay. Is that okay, or is there a risk of salmonella right there?
The most common foods that we see associated with salmonella infection include meat, poultry, and eggs. And so any time that you're eating food that has not been heated to a high enough temperature to kill off the salmonella bacteria, you run the risk of getting infected with this if you ingest it. And so we do recommend cooking eggs all the way through until the yolk is hard to decrease your risk of foodborne illness.
So you're telling me there's millions of mothers out there who used to boil the eggs and you put soldiers in and dip the eggs for kids. I used to have that as a child, and our kids have that. Is that not a good thing to do?
So we definitely recommend any eggs that are being fed, especially to children who are at higher risk of salmonella infection, that they be cooked all the way through to decrease your risk of foodborne illness.
So this sounds like you were wrong and your wife was right. Is that what I'm hearing?
It's not the first time.
Okay.
I hope I'm not causing any issue.
But you know
here.
What? I think he's right. Has the disease of salmonella improved over the years, but I think we used to eat a lot of eggs with runny yolks, and now hardly at all. Is it just because we know better, or is it because people really are getting more sick?
I think it may be a combination of both. We are lucky to live in a country that has very strict standards in terms of food production and has certain standards and regulations in place to help protect us from all of these things. But certainly because our food now comes from so many different places and in so many different ways, a lot of the times it needs to be transported over long distances, the risks are higher.
If you are going from the egg to the chicken, okay. If you have chicken that does have salmonella on it, if you cook it long enough, then one that kills the salmonella and it's not as much of a risk, or it completely erases the risk?
So there's a few important things when you're preparing meat products. So cooking meat or heating it to a high enough temperature does significantly decrease your risk of getting an infection from eating it. For chicken, for example, we recommend cooking it to an internal temperature of more than 165 degrees Fahrenheit to make sure that you kill off any bacteria that may be present. But cooking alone is not enough. We have to be very mindful when we're preparing foods. It's getting into barbecue season, people are grilling outdoors, and we see cross-contamination of different food products as a big issue. So if your salad greens come into contact with the juices from your chicken, you're not going to be heating that salad, and so that salad then becomes a potentially contaminated food that can make people sick. So when you're preparing these foods, it's really important to pay close attention to keep your meat products very separate from your fruits, vegetables, salads. Make sure that you're washing your hands very well before you start preparing the food and in between preparing different types of food. And then lastly, making sure that you're serving and storing the food in a way that's safe. Generally, you want to avoid keeping foods out in what we call the danger zone. So between 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 140 degrees Fahrenheit is kind of the ideal temperature that bacteria like to replicate in. And so we recommend not leaving food out for any more than 2 hours between those temperatures. If the outdoor temperature is greater than 90 degrees Fahrenheit, we usually recommend cutting that back to an hour.
Okay, if you're going to be at a picnic, though, I have to have potato salad at my picnic. It's just a necessity.
Of course.
If I am putting it in a bowl of ice that I think is keeping it cold enough, how do you know if I'm going to assume that I need to just stick a thermometer in there. If you're going to do that to a chicken to make sure it's over 165 degrees, what temperature do I want to keep that potato salad at?
So generally, you want to keep it as cool as possible. Anything below 40 degrees Fahrenheit is thought to be more safe than above that. And so the best way and really the only accurate way to determine the temperature is to use a thermometer. So
I was just at a picnic this past weekend, and somebody said, "How's the potato salad?" And I said, "Cold."
Great.
We all agreed that was good.
So many people, for example, on the weekend go food shopping, and they'll put their food in their trunk and go off and do other errands. And so that food has been sitting in the trunk for several hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Is that a mistake that we've been doing?
Yes. So that is kind of the ideal temperature that bacteria love to grow and replicate on. So any meat that you've purchased that may be contaminated with bacteria, even if it were a small amount, that kind of creates an ideal incubator for the bacteria to grow and replicate. And if you then go on to ingest the food, especially if it's not cooked adequately, you could be putting yourself and your family at risk.
Well, so I've been doing that for a long time inadvertently.
Remind me that if I'm ever invited to your house, to make sure that your wife is in charge of all of that.
Often we go to a restaurant and some people will want their steak well done. But if you ask for it to well done, the waiter looks at you as an insult to the chef. And so people take it rare. What's your thought about that regarding salmonella?
Sure. So there's an important distinction here between different meat products. So steak versus hamburgers. For steak, your risk of getting foodborne illness is lower because generally steak, if it's contaminated, will be contaminated on the surface of the meat since it's not been ground. If the outside of the meat gets to a hot enough temperature, the bacteria that are there will be killed off. And it's quite unusual for bacteria to be present on the middle of the steak. So generally ordering a steak rare or medium rare is relatively safe when it comes to infections like E. coli or salmonella.
So if you order a burger, on the other hand, it should be well done?
Yes. So the difference is with hamburger or hamburger patties, it's made up of ground meat. Usually that's come from multiple different animals. And so if even one of the animals has some contamination, that goes into this pooled product. So your risk of having contamination is higher to begin with. The other thing is the bacteria can be present at the very center of the burger patty. And so if you order a burger rare or medium rare, and that middle section is cool or pink, any bacteria there could definitely make you sick.
Keeping food safe at this time of year, any tips that you want to share?
Some of the really important things are just making sure that you wash your fruits and vegetables really well. It doesn't reduce the risk to zero, but it's one of the best things that we can do, especially for products that you're not going to be cooking or heating. As I mentioned, kind of making sure that you keep meat and vegetable products apart and separated. Washing your hands is really the biggest thing. We know people that are infected with salmonella or a lot of these other types of foodborne illness, they can shed the bacteria in their stool for prolonged periods of time, even after their symptoms have resolved.
My.
And so proper hand hygiene, especially when you're preparing foods for yourself and for others, is also very important.
We've been talking about food safety with infectious disease specialist Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our program for this week.
For more information about topics discussed today, visit us on the web at Mayo Clinic News Network, where you can access a podcast of today's show, previously aired programs, and the latest news from Mayo Clinic.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Sanj Kakkar.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.